Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host, and I'd like to ask you, what do you do with the shoes that are getting worn and you have new shoes and even let's call them running shoes because a lot of you are runners and we'd like to get new shoes. And what do you do with it? Where do they go? Well, actually, we have a guest on the show who figured out what to do with these old shoes. Not very old, not dilapidated shoes, but the shoes that could be used again and again, and started a charity for them called Shoe for Africa, because that's where they needed to go. And this is a man who might have started that way, and maybe, I don't know, probably hundreds of thousands of shoes have gone to Africa at this point, but he is one of the great humanitarians right now on the planet, and has made profound contributions to the world, especially to Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, and has written a book about his journey in doing this. That's maybe one of the greatest books I've ever read, because I just was absorbed in every page of it. It was very profound. And it's called Running with Destiny. And the author is with us, Toby Tanzer. Toby, welcome to Energy Stew.
Thank you so much, Peter. And likewise, I'm honored to be on the show with you. And you are one of the people that I've looked up to for a long time since my involvement with the Roadrunners Club 23 years ago. So,
well, I'm honored
to be here.
I'm very honored about that. And you know, from somebody who has really changed Africa by what you've brought it, not just shoes, but the story of how it happened, of how you started in life, really just going to Africa when you were very young, just so you could learn how to run better. And learn from the Africans who were winning world races. And along the way, discovered that life could be meaningful for these people to have much more than they were living with, that they didn't have enough. And you understood that. And even the first pair of shoes that, you know, you realize could be used. And there's a story in your book of you getting on a plane to go home, back up to Sweden where you had been training. And you're in, I guess, Nairobi, and somebody needed shoes. And you gave them the pair of shoes you were wearing, hoping that you could at least pick up some sandals on the way, but you couldn't. And when you got to Stockholm, there was a snowstorm and you had no shoes. But then this woman drove you home from the airport and you explained what had happened. And she wanted you to give her shoes to Africa, to the people who needed it. And you realized, oh my gosh, people really care about, you know, having shoes on the Africans who don't have any. Bare feet are a disaster. Maybe you think, oh, that's so natural for them. Well, that's how you pick up hookworm and all kinds of other problems. And you understood that you can make a difference, and even giving up the shoes you were wearing is a remarkable start. So I'm excited how this got going.
And truly, yeah, it's as simple as that. And you know yourself, you know, the profound difference that running made in your life. And so for me, the same thing, you know, I wasn't a runner. I was a cigarette smoker and, you know, very unhealthy. Didn't run anywhere, didn't even walk anywhere, drove a motorcycle anywhere. And then to see how running changed my life, and then to realize that, you know, by giving somebody a pair of shoes who doesn't own any footwear and then saying, you know, go, it's almost like a step forward in their life. And there was a story that best exemplifies this was a Tanzanian schoolboy who was doing nothing. And we said, well, look, you're healthy. You look like a runner. Why don't you try running? And then 5 years later, he became a world champion. And when he became a runner, how he changed his own community was outstanding. So that's a simple way of how a running shoe can change a life far more dramatically than my life was changed.
I love that story. But when I think of you as a humanitarian, I think of you as having lived through so much sacrifice. It's in your book of the struggle of getting the job done and how many times you were faced with terrible conditions that you overcame because of your determination to get shoes on the feet. And in the end, and we'll get to that, not only did you supply so many shoes for Africa, and we'll talk about why your charity is called Shoe for Africa, not Shoes for Africa. But you ended up having this huge contribution where you built a major pediatric hospital and at least seven schools, and now you're building another hospital. And it's not like Africa had any of this. You know, they didn't have pediatric hospitals. And now it's amazing what you brought to that country. And the way you've done it, it's so much part of the book is that how authentic you are, that you had no self-aggrandizement about this. You actually basically considered yourself a beggar for shoes, a beggar for money. And you just went around asking people to contribute and found enough people who believed in you and believed in your cause that you could build, you know, great monuments to the health of Africa.
Yeah, because the truth of the matter is, you know, I didn't have any really, you know, begging was my best qualification, which, you know, I learned by mistake when I ran away as a teenager to Amsterdam when I was younger and had, you know, ran out of money and learned that skill set, which, you know, again, became something very useful because charity workers, really, that's all we are. We're beggars for, but nothing was planned, absolutely nothing. And so I can't really claim any credit for anything because the opportunities just fell in front of me. And, you know, you talked about the pediatric hospital, you know, the first East and Central Africa, the public children's hospital that I built. The very morning that I decided to build the hospital, I had zero plans. So it was literally thrown in front of me in my face. And I accepted it. So, you know, you only take credit when you actually plan something. If it's something that it just falls in front of you, you can't really take credit for it.
But it's not that you just thought, oh, we need a hospital. You saw the suffering. You saw how much was missing for the children, for the people. And it was your heart that was so driven to pursue this. It wasn't anything intellectual, as we know. It was just you, your soul was into it.
Yeah, it was sadness. And, you know, I mean, I think I look at my life in many ways as being two sides of a coin. There's the pre-trouble to Africa and the after. And I'd seen a lot of poverty in the world, you know, because I'd traveled extensively as an athlete and I'd been to, for instance, I remember when they went to the Lisbon half marathon and I spent a day walking around the slums, which are right in the center of the town in Lisbon. In fact, our hotel was literally right next to the slums. And I'd seen also many different places where I'd seen, you know, terrible hardships. But when I went to East Africa, I saw a different level of poverty that really kind of shocked me. And as you said, you know, I went there with the express reason just to try to run faster, to learn from the best Kenyan runners. And then suddenly when I was there, I no longer wanted to run, you know, or put my energies wholly into being a runner. I wanted to use running as a vehicle to actually help other people rather than myself.
And it's amazing what you had to put up with. I'm thinking of this run. You actually had a little bit of leisure time in Zanzibar, and you went for a run along the beach, and you were attacked by two guys with weapons. One guy had a machete, another a bat, and they practically killed you. And the doctors, some days later, were surprised that you had survived. And yet you rehabbed and came back. And it was amazing. You know, so let's talk about why it's called Shoe for Africa, not Shoes for Africa. You want to tell that story?
It's a long story. I'll try and say it as briefly as possible. As you say, I was running along the beach in Zanzibar, and it was the most beautiful afternoon. The Indian Ocean was to my right, and the sun was dropping, so they've got this golden tilt on top of the waves, and those two dolphins that were just jumping out of the water, almost observing me. And on the other side was just a line of palm trees. And usually the sand is pretty bumpy and hard to run on. You know, you can sprain an ankle or stress an Achilles. But today, for some reason, the water had smoothed over the sand. It was a perfect surface. And I was trying to do a tempo run, you know, trying to run as fast as I could for 3 miles, going faster and faster and everything. I just didn't feel any resistance at all. And I felt like I could take off and fly. And I'd just come from training with the world's best runners in Kenya. So I was in excellent form. And two men walked out of the coconut trees towards me, and they were wearing jackets, which I found rather odd because it was steaming hot, and just starting walking. And I thought, oh, all they're doing is just coming to say, hi, how are you? And so many people over my years in Kenya, especially, had been so friendly that here in Zanzibar, I expected nothing else. I thought these people were just coming of saying greetings to me. But when they were two strides away from me, one of the shorter guy who had like a jacket with, you know, like a three-piece suit type jacket, he put his hand inside the jacket and he pulled out a machete and went straight for my forehead, coming down with a chopping action. And it was a shock. You know, I just literally, with a reaction that just was natural, my hand flew up in front of my face to stop the blow. And so the machete came down on my wrist and blood splattered everywhere. But unfortunately, the other person who was carrying also a jacket, he'd got a club, like a handmade baseball club, hidden behind. And he swung as if I was a golf ball and he cracked open my skull. And that, running from that situation, I actually got up and I ended up fighting with them, but I managed to get hold of the machete. And then when I got the machete, I became the aggressor. But after they left, I was faced with a situation where I had to run to save my life because I had to do the 3 miles back to where I started from.
And when you were on the ground, you heard a voice tell you to get up and get going.
That was very, very weird. Yeah, I mean, here I was running at full speed, 5 minute mile pace. And then, so my heart should have been racing from that tempo run on the sand. And then I'd been involved in this brawl. So again, my heart rate should be beating and beating, but I wanted to go to sleep. And something told me, if I go to sleep, everything will be okay. So I went down on the sand and I put my good arm to actually lay my head against the sand. And then, yeah, like an electric shock, this voice came out of nowhere saying, get up, you have more to do, get up. And that was when I first got scared. That was the incident where I actually felt fear and realized, yeah, if I lay down on the beach, I'm going to bleed to death because I'd lost so much blood. I was the only one that was bleeding. There was blood over me. There was blood on my shoes. There's blood on my singlet. My shorts were soaked in blood. And I was bleeding profusely from the head and the wrist. So I realized, yes, I'd lost so much of my blood that if I did go to sleep on the beach, the chances are I would have never woken up.
So the voice came from somewhere, your higher self, your soul, who knows. But it was a warning to get going. But let's talk about the shoe.
The Nike Pegasus, the shoe. It was a very beautiful shoe that I lost. It was a silver shoe. But so that was a name. So, you know, I realized, okay, if they're willing to kill people for a pair of shoes, because the ironic thing at this stage, I'd already sent, you know, thousands of pairs of shoes back to Kenya and Morocco and indeed Tanzania. So here was this ironic situation where I was being robbed for my pair of shoes, where had they even asked me, I would have given them my shoes. I would have said, okay, when I finish the training run, you know, drop by the hotel and I'll give you these shoes. But they didn't ask. And I thought, if these people are so desperate, and I don't blame them. I don't know what circumstances led them to the stage where they had to rob somebody for their secondhand shoes. But I was thinking, if this is a fact, and then I was sponsored by Nike at the time, so for me, just to give away my own footwear was, you know, no big deal. But I thought, if I can make a difference and help stop other attacks like this happening, and also, you know, I realized then, I think, I never realized the worth of a running shoe more than at that period. And then that's why the organization became a shoe, meaning a step forward for Africa. But then, of course, people thought it was shoes for Africa because generally I was sending shoes over. But it was more than that. I just wanted to help in every single way that I could for
and also
people that
they,
I...
They had only gotten one shoe.
So, correct, yeah, because I woke up when they were, you know, they knocked me out cold. I was lying flat on the sand and they were struggling because I triple knot my, as a lot of runners do, with my laces to stop their shoelace coming undone in the middle of a tempo run. So, yeah, and so I stayed with one shoe. But by the luck of the gods, they also stole the left shoe. So I was able to kickstart my motorbike because I also needed my motorbike. And even though I was half blind, I could not see and had blood running down and I was dizzy and I was seeing blurs and worry things. I needed my motorcycle to actually drive me to a medical clinic. So thank goodness that I remained with the right shoe.
But you couldn't really get the right help for about 9 days. And they wondered, doctors wondered how you survived that. And
yeah,
when
I finally got, when I got to Charing Cross in London, which again, you know, was by an absolute miracle and by good luck of the Indian doctor that I met wandering around the streets of Dar es Salaam, begging to get me on a plane. Four separate neurosurgeons told me the same thing. They said the size of the blood clot next to your brain, pushing it across, you should have been dead within 4 days. And the weird thing is, a friend of mine who had been trying to visit his parents just before my accident had died of a similar accident, you know, being hit on the head, but he was with a car wing mirror and he had died after 4 days. So here was I being told, you know, there's no reason how you've survived this accident because I didn't have antibiotics. I didn't have anesthetics, you know, all of the head wound was washed with soap and water. And then I was stitched up. And 2 days later, I managed to get antibiotics by this Indian doctor, but he knew how serious my wounds were and that I was having seizures. You know, my body was just shutting down. He said, we have to get you off the island. We have to get you help. But it took 11 days.
And he was a big inspiration for you also.
Huge, absolutely huge. And the funny thing about him was, as bad as my injuries were, and you know, I had pus coming out of my head, and I, you know, I couldn't tell the difference between left or right. I couldn't walk without stumbling. And he kept on telling me, no, don't worry, you're all right. This is all part of your journey. You'll understand later. You're going to survive this because you have a purpose in life for coming to Africa. And he was convinced. And my question was, well, am I actually even going to live to see this purpose? But he was saying, ah, you know, don't worry. There is a bigger purpose. There is a bigger purpose for you in life to why you came to Africa.
And then what's interesting is that you had another accident years later, a bike accident in New York, where you also had to have brain surgery and it was on the other side of your head.
By good luck.
But what was fascinating was that when you were in recovery from that at Harlem Hospital, they put you in the presidential suite, which was a luxurious, you know, hospital suite. And you wondered, what am I doing here? You know, why should I be in this incredible suite? And the doctors, because it was Harlem Hospital, they said, we know what you've done for Africa.
And yeah, no, it was very touching and it was so helpful. I mean, Harlem Hospital, I can't say enough good things about them, you know, and how they treated me and how they were. And I think, yeah, they banded together. They were inspired by the, you know, at that stage, and I was trying to build. I just started 2 months earlier. I just, you know, laid the first foundation stone and we'd actually just gone into building this first hospital. So I think, yeah, that helped them to heal me better. But the first thing they wanted to know was what the heck happened on the other side of your head? Because, you know, now I have metal plates on both the left and the right side. So it's not usual.
Well, I'm glad that you have a clear mind. So it's amazing though that you've been challenged in life in so many ways. And I'm thinking of the run you did from Mombasa to the peak of Kilimanjaro to raise $125,000 for the hospital. And the first 30 miles was in like 114 degree temperature, and your support team couldn't keep up with you through traffic, and you didn't have the fluids you needed, and you could have died from that. And
it was horrible, horrible. Because I'm not an ultra runner. I like to run 3 miles or 4 miles. I do not like to run ultra distances.
Well, this was 8 days of ultra distances to raise $125,000 for the hospital. And it's providence to keep you going and to get you to that peak of Kilimanjaro. That was a great feat. And all you could think of, it's in the book, that all you could think of along the way was how important that money was for the hospital. And you know, it wasn't about yourself. I mean, the whole book is filled with you living in sacrifice because you're not into self-aggrandizement. You're not into how much money can you make. As a matter of fact, you've always done it by the cheap. And people have said to you many times, look, when you're raising this much money for charity, you got to take a whole lot for yourself. And you go, no, I don't take anything. I really want to give it all to the work, and it's amazing how life has supported you being able to do that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, again, what helped me was I didn't have anything really, you know, when I was asking for money, I had nothing to offer. You know, I didn't have any skills. I wasn't a doctor. I wasn't an architect. So the only thing I could tell people was, you know, if you give me any money, I promise 100% of this money will go directly towards building a children's hospital, because it's said over 50% of all the aid money that's channeled to Africa stays in America. And when you start to realize that, you know, most organizations that build, you know, huge hospitals and things like this usually have offices and a staff and, you know, pay salaries and things. I just wanted to see, you know, can I do it just by spending absolutely nothing and just putting all the money towards the project? And I thought that would also inspire me to get better deals with the workmanship over in Kenya and things. So.
Right. And the workers in Kenya were very surprised that you were helping them lay the stone.
Even, I mean, they're used to, you know, foreigners coming in, making a donation, smiling, you know, cutting a ribbon and then disappearing up until the opening day. Believe it, I was, you know, carrying the shovels. I was mixing the cement. I was up on the roof. That's when I felt alive. That's when when I'm fundraising, it doesn't matter the size of the donation. It makes me feel alive to be a part of the project. And when I've taken money from people, I felt that responsibility that I have to be there also to check that it's spelt correctly, that nobody steals bags of cement or anything like that, that everything is done to the best of my ability.
Yeah, but also it goes beyond that, because there were so many times where at one point, for instance, when there's political strife and people were getting killed, different tribes were killing each other, you established a peace march. And, you know, I mean, it's real humanitarian work. It's not just about building buildings. It's about helping the people in every way that you can. And I'm so excited that you take on these responsibilities of creating progress where other people aren't, you know, that you're, it's the leadership that you bring to it. That's wonderful. And there's so much, the book is so full of incredible details and all the people that have come into your life who are part of it. I learned so much about all these top Kenyan runners who not only helped you with running and all that, but their lives and how they struggled in their hometowns and how much they also put into helping others, and the teamwork with you and them was amazing to read about. There's so much that I think people will appreciate reading your book, Running with Destiny. And it's an odyssey of mistakes, machetes, and miracles. And I love that. And so we're getting near the end of the show. Time flies. And you do have a website, right?
Yes, it's my surname, TANSER.org.
Tanser.org.
Correct.
That's simple. People should get that right away and get the book. Because it really, I have to say, it's one of the best books I've ever read. And I really mean it. And I've read, you know, books for hundreds of shows over the years. And so I know when I'm reading a great one.
Well, thank you. And, you know, a compelling reason I tell people, please buy the book, is 100% of the author royalties go to my next project, which is building the first children's cancer hospital for sub-Saharan Africa. So that's really why I actually wrote this book. It was the driving force for the next project that I want to do.
Of course. Well, what else can we expect from one of the great humanitarians?
Oh, thank you, Peter.
So this has been wonderful talking with you. I know, and we have known each other from years ago. And
yep.
And it's great to get more detail from reading the book. And I want to thank you for everything. And hopefully we'll be talking more, because it's exciting to be inspired by you.
Thank you for inviting me on your show, Peter.
Sure. Yeah, my pleasure. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.live. And I can be reached at peter@heartriver.org. I'd love to hear from you. And thanks so much for listening.